Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 128, which is the second part of our look at coprolite inclusions. In the first part of this episode, which of course you've all listened to by now, we spoke to Martin Q and Martin F about their respective fields of coprolites and of beetles, setting us up now to discuss the remarkable discovery of beetles within a Triassic dinosaur coprolite. It's obviously a really cool find in and of itself, but we cover so much more in this interview considering the significance for studies of both beetles and of dinosaurs, but also the potential fossil poop has for preserving other fossils within it. I found this to be a really captivating interview, and I hope you will do so too. Remember that if you want to see the fossils that we're talking about, then head on over to our website where we have pictures and videos of the specimens. And if you enjoy this interview, then a like, share, comment, or subscribe will all really help the show get noticed by more people on social media, and so we'd be very grateful. I hope you enjoy this episode. You've mentioned then that we've got a beetle in a coprolite, which I'm sure anyone listening to this could have figured out this is the direction that this interview is going in. So, Martin Q, I'm guessing you made the discovery as someone that was looking at the coprolites. Were you surprised when you found it?
Yeah, so we were looking at a whole bunch of coprolites from this locality. And I had two students doing a project where they looked at a few of them. And then we looked through this small fragment of a coprolite, which it really is. And we didn't expect to find so much in it because it's so small. But we were totally wrong because we're just packed of you know, small beetle remains. And at first we saw all these elytra and small fragments, but also something that looked like whole beetles, but we weren't sure because we were just looking at these scans at initially at a quite low resolution. But we've scanned the specimen in quite high resolution because we use the like synchrotron microtomography, so it's like a CT scanner at the hospital, but like a lot more powerful, so you can get really good resolution but also see small density differences in the objects. So we looked at the high resolution scans, and then these like almost fully articulated specimens showed up at the screen initially. And it took us quite a while to segment all the details and get the legs and antennae and stuff like that out. But we were totally amazed by the preservation of the beetles. And we saw that they looked very similar to one another. And all these like overlap that we had in the various specimens led us to think that perhaps it would be possible to identify or describe this as a new species, or at least identify it to a genus level. But of course, we're not beetle experts, so that's where Martin and two other colleagues came into the picture to help us out identifying this specimen.
Before we get into the identity of the beetle, let's work on the identity of the coprolite. So can you tell us about its geological setting? Where was it found? How old is it? And what kind of environment was it preserved in?
So the coprolite comes from a locality in southern Poland called Krasiów. And in Krasiów, we have a lot of fossils derived from this big clay pit that is nowadays a theme park, actually. and these fossils are both from its aquatic animals, so we have a lacustrine or fluvial setting mixed with terrestrial animals in various horizons with fossils, and a whole bunch of coprolites. We don't have any radiometric date, so we don't know the exact age, the absolute age, but if we look at various small fossils and also the tetrapod fauna, it looks like it's a late Carnian assemblage, which translates into an age of about 230 million years.
So is that Triassic?
Yeah, exactly. So it's the late Triassic. But it's also, it's 230 million years ago. So it's when we get the first dinosaurs, but dinosaurs haven't yet taken over and become ecologically dominant on Earth. We have some dinosaurs and close relatives of dinosaurs, but they're not as diverse and abundant as they will be in the latest part of the Triassic, and then of course in the Jurassic and Cretaceous. But it's the environment is fluvial, probably seasonal, dry versus wet seasons, and we have tons of different animals. We have both the aquatic ones, so big amphibians, various fishes, sharks, and so on, and a big phytosaur that looked a bit like a crocodile, paleorhinos that was swimming and hunting bigger fish probably. And then we have a terrestrial assemblage consisting of Psilosaurus, this really early dinosaur relative, Polynosuchus, a big Brachiosaurus, so a relative of crocodiles, but didn't look much like a crocodile, more dinosaur-like appearance, and a big Aetosaur, so a herbivorous animal, and a few others. So. Not many dinosaurs, really. It's just Psilosaurus, the small little guy with a beak at the tip of his jaws, a really slender animal, probably just weighing something like 15, 20 kilos. It's the most likely producer of the coprolite.
Okay, I know this question started with me asking about the environment in the Triassic. I now want to know about this environment in 2021, and especially the theme park. So we can refer to it as Coprolite Land, and I'm sure it's a remarkable place. Do they know that there's all these fossils in their theme park? When you're doing work, do you stop off and have a go on a roller coaster?
So I've only visited this locality once. So most of the all the coprolites that we've been analyzed now are collected by Grzegorz Niedźwiedzki, and there are ongoing fieldworks there all the time. But the theme park is actually called Jura Park, even though it's a Triassic locality, this one. You have all these roller coasters and stuff, but also a lot of information about, you know, what is found there, and you have like life through Earth's history, and so it's also educational in a sense. But it's very interesting. I've never been to, you know, a locality before where there is a huge theme park and you can work a little bit and then take a roller coaster ride and then sit and sip on a beer. So it's a very interesting locality in that respect.
That's incredible. I was being very facetious, suggesting that the theme park would be paleo related, but having a paleo related theme park on a site where there is actually fossils preserved, that's quite incredible. I've never heard of that, and I want to go. Yes. So.
Yeah, it's amazing, and what is mostly interesting with the theme park and the museum is that you have some surfaces where you have skulls of these various amphibians, especially Metoposaurus, still in the rocks, and then they've put like a building on top of that, and you have this glass surface, so you can like almost walk over them and see these fossils still in situ, so still in place where they were found. So that's pretty interesting.
Okay, so you've mentioned the dinosaur Coelurosaurus, was the likely producer, but then you also have those other crocodiles that crocodile relatives that are also going to be carnivorous. How can you be sure? How can you reliably infer that the dinosaur was the producer of the coprolite and not one of the other organisms?
Well, simply put, we can't. So we can't be sure that Coelurosaurus was the producer of this coprolite. But the reason why we think so is that we had a look at a few coprolites previously containing various disarticulated beetle remains and a lot of small bits and pieces of insects that we couldn't really identify. So it seems like we have an animal from this assemblage that was targeting insects and possibly other other food sources, but an animal that wasn't really small itself, judging by the size of the coprolites. And the best candidate is Psilosaurus, if we look at the body fossil record from the site. And it's also interesting if you look at a few anatomical characters in Psilosaurus. For example, this beak at the tip of his jaw. And we hypothesized that the beak was used when foraging. So maybe rooting in the litter and going through, like, you know, dead wood and so on in search of insects and other prey. But it also, we can't be sure that Psilosaurus was strictly insectivorous just based on the insects and beetles that we find in the coprolites. My best bet is that Psilosaurus was probably omnivorous, so eating insects as a part of the diet, perhaps seasonal, or you know, that other food remains are just not preserved in the coprolites or in these coprolites, because our sample size here is not that great. So we can't be 100% sure about the producer, of course, and that's almost always the case when working on coprolites. But we can use all the evidence we have and say, like, okay, this is the most probable producer. And those kind of links become even stronger when we look at all the coprolites from the locality, because then we have groups of coprolites and we can see, okay, we have quite big coprolites and regurgitates that, or regurgitalites of fossilized vomits or regurgitates that contain a lot of, you know, bigger bone pieces and so on. So that's from a bigger predator. And then we can step by step try to understand more about this as a living ecosystem.
And how does the inferred diet compare to its dentition? Because a lot of times, a lot of times diets of paleo organisms are inferred from their dentition.
Yeah, so if we look at the psilosaurids in general, there have been various ideas about their diets, if they were omnivorous or herbivorous and so on. Now, if we look at psilosaurus, we have these fairly small teeth, conical shape with small serrations, and it's not been entirely clear if they were herbivorous or omnivorous. And basically the coprolites and the insect contents is like the first evidence of showing that they might also be partly insectivorous. So it's still, you know, a bit of a question mark, of course, the overall diet. But my best bet, again, would be that it's an omnivorous diet.
Okay, this is a theropod we're talking about, isn't it?
No. Actually, it depends a little bit on who you ask exactly where to place Psilosaurus in the tree, as you were discussing before about phylogenies and so on. But it's... the psilosaurids are like the closest relatives of dinosaurs. And some people place it within Dinosauria as a sort of stem ornithischian. But regardless, it's at the very base of the dinosaur tree. And probably, yeah, it's best to say like a dinosaur ancestor, or possibly even early dinosaur. So it's a dinosauriform.
Okay, my apologies. I'm not a dinosaur-y person. As no worries. Everyone knows. Okay, so how many beetle specimens were discovered in total? Was it just an isolated one, or was it absolutely jam-packed with beetle remains?
Absolutely jam-packed. So if we look at the... it's just a small fragment of a coprolite, this. So it's about 2 centimeters in diameter and very incomplete. It was once an elongated specimen, probably, but now it's just like 1.5 centimeters in length, and yet it was just packed with beetles. So I think there were approximately 50 elytra, and then a lot of small bits and pieces, you know, isolated sclerites, and then we have, I think it's 9 near complete specimens, or they're of different stages of disarticulation, of which 2 are like near complete with the antennae and the legs and so on. So quite a lot of them.
Okay, which other inclusions were found, and what proportion were beetles and what proportions were, say, like twigs or whatever?
Well, of the identifiable remains, beetles are perhaps making up like 90%, 95% of the inclusion in this particular coprolite. We have small pieces of what we think might be degraded wood, and then small networks of fungi that was probably colonizing the feces after it was deposited. So of what we can identify and what we can say was ingested was mostly beetles. But then, of course, the animal could have eaten stuff that never showed up in the coprolite, like soft tissued animals, for example, that didn't have any hard tissues that would end up in the coprolite in a recognizable form, for example.
Okay, so it's just kind of potentially concentrated the hardest bits and everything else has been digested. Get it?
Yeah, exactly. We have to always remember that we, with fossils in general, right, that we get a very biased view of what actually was happening because we just see whatever gets preserved.
Okay, so you found these beetles, you pick up the phone, you call Martin F., say, look, we've got all of these beetles. We need a hand. So, Martin, passing over to you then, how did you get involved in this? And then also, can we start to explore a bit about these beetles? They've been digested. Like, they've been eaten, potentially chewed, and then in all the stomach acid. How were they well preserved? Were they difficult to identify? Could you see any corrosion or digestion in them?
Actually, this is the thing which confuses many people, because naturally the complete specimens are those which are shown in the paper, like the most apparent ones, and mentioned even in all the, you know, like popular articles and so on. But actually, most of the specimens which were in the coprolite, they were not complete. They were these isolated elytra or like pieces of beetles. And there are just these 9 specimens which are nearly complete. So we can say that most of the ingested specimens were actually damaged. So that's also how we are actually kind of sure that it was really eaten by the reptile. Because we would not guess something like that if these beetles would be, for example, the dung beetle, right? We would not guess that most of them would be kind of digested, disarticulated, and just few would be complete. We would expect the opposite. So there are actually many. It was, in fact, the good thing. In the beginning, I was looking at that like, okay, we have just few specimens, and Martin can tell you how kind of pessimistic I was. I wrote them several emails back like, okay, I can try, but I cannot really promise anything, because in my head I had two things. One was what I already mentioned, that I have to compare it to 350,000 other beetle species to be sure what it is, right? Another thing is that from my previous experience with beetle fossils, it happens time to time that you have some super nicely looking, like amazing fossil, this kind of showpiece, right? But this is not always the one which is good to identify, because you can see nice fossil, but you cannot see really the details which we need to identify where this beetle belongs to. So I was really afraid of that. And actually on the models, which otherwise look very complete, I was really not able to see all the needed details. So I was in the beginning a little bit kind of disappointed and thinking how I should write back carefully to Martin Q, that saying like, oh, maybe I should give up. But then I realized one thing, that we had these disarticulated kind of pieces of the same beetle, right? In the same coprolite. So we actually tried to do something like a puzzle. So we tried to take these pieces because we also had the 3D models of these pieces, and we knew how the complete beetle looks like because we have these few complete specimens. So it's something like with the puzzle, you know what's the photo of the puzzle, right? and we had the pieces. So we tried to kind of put these pieces together. And this actually was the kind of critical moment when I was able finally to see when each structure ends and other structure starts, when the sutures between these so-called sclerites, which are these kind of chitinized plates of which the insect body is composed of, where they start, where they finish, how they are connected. And this is the way how we actually identify beetles. So this saved the case, and we were able to find so many details that we were not only sure that it is this Myxophaga group, which we will probably talk about later, but that it is also a family which did not survive until today.
So was this beetle a new species, and to which groups did it belong?
Yeah, so it's definitely a new species, which naturally is not that surprising, because once you go such a long time in the past, right, probably everything what we can find is something which was never seen before. But in this case, it's not only new species, but also new genus and new family. So it means basically something like a new lineage of beetles, which was not known until now. We had no idea that some kind of evolutionary group or evolutionary clade of beetles like that existed before we found Triamyxa. So we call the beetle Triamyxa, which is basically a combination of Tria from Triassic and Myxa from this Myxophaga, which is the group where the beetle belongs to. And the species name is Coprolitica, referring to the coprolite, because it's basically the first ever insect described from the coprolite. So we wanted to kind of highlight that by the name.
That's quite a cool thing to have done, named the first insect in a coprolite.
Yeah. So actually, Martin Q had a few more other insects. There were some few remains of the bigger beetle in the same coprolite. So probably there were also some bigger beetles eaten by this reptile. And I think Martin also published few other kind of analyses of few other coprolites, and they had some pieces of beetles. But these were two fragmentary. So this was not really enough to kind of say that this is this family of beetles or this genus. We would not be able to really say that. So this Triamyxa was actually the first insect ever which was complete enough. And so we can actually name it.
And were the remains all external? So arthropods and beetles have their exoskeleton on the inside. That's where they have the organs and the hemolymph and stuff like that. It's all wet and gooey. Were they just kind of empty shells, or was there anything inside?
Actually, we did not really check that in detail, but I checked the scans because I got the full data from Martin. So I was kind of playing with them in my computer using a little bit lower resolution and easier program than Martin used later for these super nice models. But there is definitely, in these few complete specimens, there's definitely something inside. So I think once we maybe later have like even better technology for micro CT scanning, we can maybe still discover more interesting things like what these beetles ate, right? Or something like that. So this is definitely not hollow. It's definitely not empty. Compared to these fragments, which are actually the opposite, these fragments, so once the beetle actually got kind of crushed in pieces, then probably the body cavity got exposed to these digestive fluids inside of the digestive system of the reptile. And these pieces are completely clean. So this is actually the way how I do study of modern beetles. Like once I want to identify something and I have a beetle which I really don't know where it belongs to, so I have to see all the details. What I do is I take the specimen, I crush it in pieces, and I put it in potassium, KOH, potassium hydroxide. And this chemical actually eats all the soft tissue. And so I only had super cleaned kind of sclerites and this chitin parts, right? And this is what actually we see in the coprolite about these fragments of beetles. So these were super nicely cleaned, probably by the digestive fluids of the dinosaur. But those which remained complete, they actually were kind of protected by this external shell of the beetle, and the digestive fluids probably did not really get inside of the beetle that much. So I still think that we can find something inside once we have like better technology. The problem is that the beetle is 1 millimeter long. So it's already getting the complete beetle is kind of not that easy. And getting the details like the number of antennomeres, for example, or some tiny details which we need for identification was even more difficult. And for the internal things, we would need probably even more details. So this is nowadays, as far as I know, the like beyond the resolution of the scan.
Maybe I can jump in there and just say, so the coprolite was scanned with a resolution of about 6.5 microns. And it's possible now to go down and do even sub-micron scans. But of course, we didn't do that when we were there because we didn't know it would contain these really small beetles. So, but as Martin is saying here, it would be something very interesting to do in the future, of course. So we'll see. Maybe we will scan this specimen again and look at some of these specimens in even higher resolution.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I like to think of insects and other arthropods as kind of wearing a spacesuit in a way. So they all came from, evolved in an aquatic environment. And when they came onto land, the reason they were so successful initially is that they are completely encased. They're kind of isolated from the outside world by their exoskeletons. And all of their ecological interactions are done through the exoskeleton. They've only really got the mouth and the gut that are openings. And so, yeah, I completely see that it is possible for something as well armored as a beetle to be in an environment with all of these digestive enzymes. And if they pass through quick enough, then they could potentially be not very affected by that.
Yeah, precisely. This is what we actually even can test with modern beetles. There were some studies, not about this, but about how the beetles can be preserved and what can be something like the bias of like the what is preserved in the fossil record compared to the what is really living in the place. There were many studies in so-called taphonomy. It was done for beetles. In many cases, there's a group in University of Colorado, which did many studies of that. And I think we can actually do the same with the digesting kind of effectivity, right? We can feed some result with insects and see what's going on out of that. So that would be possible even to test if we want.
Cool. So you've said that the Trimixia wasn't coprophagous, so it wasn't eating the poop. It didn't move into it after it was deposited. But can we say anything about its ecology? Do we know how it lived? Can you infer anything based on its morphology to say this is what this beetle was doing and this is how it lived?
Yeah, definitely. So first thing is many people criticized something like, okay, this beetle definitely has to be a dung beetle, right? This is the first thing which you think about, okay, there's a beetle in the fossilized dung, so it should be a dung beetle. So basically we were thinking about that by ourselves in the beginning, naturally, and also during the review process, this was kind of criticized and we were asked by the reviewers the same questions. And we actually can very easily rule it out. Because one thing is that there are no tunnels in the coprolite. So we know some dung beetle kind of tunnels, fossilized ones from I think late Cretaceous. So they were kind of going through the dinosaur or whatever excrements, and you can always see them kind of nicely that there was something tunneling in the excrement. This is not the case. I think in the scan there was nothing like that visible. And there's no indication that there were any tunnels inside. Another thing is what I already mentioned is the thing about that only if some specimens are complete, but most of them are basically disarticulated and kind of cleaned by the digestive fluids, right? So this would not probably happen once it's a dung beetle. Then we actually have some filamentous kind of remains in the same coprolite, which we don't know what actually it is, but it can be the algae. And that actually goes to what we think that these beetles were living like. This group where this Trimyxa is belonging to is called Myxophaga. And all these beetles nowadays, we have four families living until today. They live in the moist or wet environment somehow associated with algae. They're actually even probably feeding on algae. And very typically, you can find them in large numbers in some spots which has some good conditions for them. So, for example, here in Taiwan 2 years ago, we collected in one place like millions of them. This was a sun-exposed, wet concrete wall. So there was some water flowing on the concrete surface. It was sun-exposed, so enough light, and there were probably enough nutrients in the water as well. So it was completely covered by the green layer of algae. And this is where we found this kind of super numerous accumulation of these tiny beetles. So we actually think that Trimyxa was living the same way. That's also probably the reason why this reptile, this Silosaurus, ate so many of them at once. So probably it was not really kind of focusing these super tiny beetles. I think the reptile is too large to really be able to recognize 1 millimeter long beetle. It was probably either eating some other beetles or insects kind of crawling around this algae, or maybe even eating the algae, who knows. And maybe these filaments which we have there can be the remains of algae, right? We have filamentous algae today, so maybe that's it. And another thing is that no member of this Myxophaga group are dung beetles nowadays. All of them are just kind of unusual water beetles living in some water environment, which is kind of this very shallow, moist habitat with algae. So that would be something like new thing for the group, which naturally we cannot rule out. But the explanation that they actually live the same as they live today is much more easier, actually.
This is amazing. It's kind of like Russian dolls with ecology. So you have a dinosaur poop. It's got beetles in it. So you look at the beetles and find that they lived in this environment. And then you can place the dinosaur in that environment eating the beetles. So Silosaurus is obviously walking around. It's wet. It's looking through the algae and picking out beetles.
Yeah. Probably, yes. And that's actually the cool thing that, for Martin Q and all the paleovertebratologists, the coprolites are basically the way how to understand the biology of these animals, right? It's not about the bones, but it's about how they live, what they eat, and so on. And if we can identify the insects inside, we can actually say even more. So we can say not only that this animal was like insects, insectivorous, insect feeding. But we can also say, okay, it was probably foraging in some kind of, streamside environment, let's say. This is where this algae are usually found. So maybe in the future, once more coprolites can be scanned, this can be the way not only to discover many more interesting insects and understand more the evolution of insects and beetles, but also to actually understand more the biology of all these reptiles or other vertebrates.
And that's how I'd really like to conclude this interview now, looking at what the association of insects and coprolites can tell us, and how far do you think that we'll be able to push that and get information about the ecology of both groups. So do we find insects enough to be able to start to use them in such a way in coprolites?
So there are not too many insects described from coprolites yet. We have a few examples from the very same site as this coprolite we've been discussing today, and also one or two examples from the Triassic of Australia, where you have a cast of a beautifully preserved insect head, but usually it's small bits and pieces. And I think we shouldn't expect to find articulated specimens a lot, like for example Trimyxa here. It's probably something really unusual and connected to the very small size of Trimyxa and the fact that it was ingested in such a large number. But it's going to be very interesting to take this information of not only the insects preserved in coprolites, but also other food remains, and then try to link them to producers and get a more overall picture of the food web of the ecosystem. So really trying to understand the dynamics of the ecosystem and even compare them through time. So what we're going to do next is look at a few different vertebrate assemblages spanning a time interval of approximately 230 million years ago to 200 million years ago. So the time period when dinosaurs are taking over and becoming ecologically dominant on Earth. And we want to see what happens to, are there any changes in the food webs and in the dynamics of these ecosystems? And insects are going to be a part of that. But also, of course, we include all kinds of food remains that we'll find. So bones and fish remains. There is a lot of coprolite producers eating fish in this, for example, from this locality in Krasiov, but also from a few other sites that we're looking at. So it's going to be really interesting to do a more large scale analysis of the food webs and compare them across time.
Yeah, one of my questions was going to be whether, I mean, because this is a really cool story in and of itself, a beetle in a coprolite, but I was going to ask as to what the wider significance of it was and what it could tell us about dinosaurs or insects and their evolution in general. So it looks like you're already going down that route. Martin F., is there anything from the beetle side that this can tell us?
Yeah, definitely. There's actually big hope of mine that more things can be found. Like, as Martin Q mentioned, it will be probably rare, right? To find like complete or nearly complete specimens, that will be probably something very, very rare, and we have to be quite lucky to find it. But this is actually how all fossils are. This is always kind of very lucky finds, it's kind of a probability, right? It's like we have to go through thousands of tons of stones to find some good fossils. It's the same with amber. Like now we have so many specimens from, let's say, Burmese amber. But in reality, if you talk to the people who are kind of selling or examining these fossils, they actually examine like kilograms, tons of things before they can find some exceptionally preserved specimens. So I actually hope that with the coprolites, even through the probability to get kind of complete nice beetles preserved is low, that if more people check it and if we will scan more frequently, not me because I'm not a paleontologist, but other paleontologists will try to do it, then we will actually kind of increase the probability that we can find something interesting and we will actually really find something interesting. And that would be really cool for several reasons, because for beetles, for example, Triassic is the time when all modern groups of beetles kind of started to diversify. They started to boom, right? And so we can kind of guess that it happened at that time based on the DNA studies. So we basically can construct the DNA, the evolutionary tree of beetles based on DNA of modern beetles. We can kind of calibrate it by some fossils, and we can estimate the age more or less for all, for example, modern families, let's say. So in that way, we know that it was in the Triassic when most modern families or the more superfamilies or the more modern, most modern groups started to appear and flourish. But we don't know how this beetle looked like. We don't know how this beetle lived. So if we now will have some chance to actually get the fossils and the fossils in very nice style of preservation, we have 3D things in with all the tiny details, that would say us a lot about why actually beetles became such a successful group as they are nowadays. So that's my hope, and that's actually for me the most important thing of our study, to inspire other people to check more coprolites.
I was going to ask if you were tempted to start examining them yourself to cut and explore coprolites, but no, I think it's important that you keep Martin Q happy and dissecting coprolites for you.
It's actually not about that. I would naturally like to try I have to honestly admit that I never found any fossil which I later studied. I always relied on the really big work of all the other paleontologists who spent years in the field to find all the specimens I was later studying. And it's always like that. But actually, one thing which I find always in every case once I start to work in with some fossil, which is very interesting, actually the limiting information for me to identify the beetle is the missing information about the modern things. It's really surprising. I would never say that we know so little about the modern beetles. So every time once I identify something, even for this paper, I had to actually go to the museum collection in Prague. I had to take the specimens of the modern beetles. I have to dissect them to see actually the precisely the same structures I can see in the fossil. Because you cannot find information about all these structures because normally we are not looking at them. Normally you can see everything. So people look at the characters which are easy or somehow apparent or whatever. You cannot get information about everything. So actually, fossils for me is the biggest kind of inspiration to discover new things about modern beetles. So that's why I think we need people like me, which are kind of ignorant about fossils and they are only time to time really getting to that and getting inspired, because we really have so much work with modern beetles to learn, which will be needed to actually interpret the fossils and the evolution of the group of beetles more kind of in detail and more correctly.
Wow, that's amazing. Like, to think that, you're looking at the biggest group of animals on the planet, and this is an important calibration point for understanding how they evolved. And a story that has been picked up in the media is just we found a bug in a poop can, you know, be so important for the majority of, not the majority of animal life, but the biggest group of animals on the planet today.
Definitely. So one thing is, when I started as a student to look at beetles, for example, this was a long time ago, maybe 15 years ago. At that time, still, there was kind of an idea that the Mesozoic beetles, for example, was something really different from the modern fauna, right? So I even visited a famous paleontologist, so beetle person doing fossil beetles in Russia, and he describes hundreds of things and really cool fossils which they have in Russia. But he basically classified everything in as a new genera, extinct families. And because the idea was that all these groups was a different fauna, right? This was like different thing from what is living today. And I started to check it. And at the same time, there were more beetle persons started working with fossils. We realized like, oh, damn, but it actually looks like the modern ones. And later the Burmese Emperor appeared with all the super nicely preserved fossils. And it became clear that you actually in Burmese Emperor, which is 100 million years old thing, you can find even the same genera as are living today. So actually the Cretaceous, the Burmese Emperor time, is still too young to understand really the origins of beetles. So now we are actually going back. We can maybe go back to the Triassic, when we are finally finding something kind of extinct and maybe different, maybe not, because this Triamyxa is like separate family, but still probably ecologically, even morphologically, quite similar already to everything which we know today. So maybe these beetles kind of had this lifestyle and the successful morphology and biology already 230 million years ago, and we would need to go even more back, right? So that would be that, but we don't know. We don't have any information how these beetles look like. So maybe if we have all the coprolite data later, maybe we can repeat what happened with the Burmese Emperor. We can kind of figure out that, okay, even in the Triassic, we already have something like the modern fauna, and we have to go even more to the past. I don't know. But that would be really, that's really amazing to kind of think that way and wait what will be discovered soon.
Yeah, wow. And then just to wrap things up, I want to know about coprolites as a preservational medium and the potential for these studies in future. Could we even go so far as to say a coprolite is kind of like a micro Lagerstätten a little site of special preservation just within this little coprolite.
I would definitely agree with you on that. I think that coprolites are like mini Lagerstätten, both in a sense, konservat and koncentrat Lagerstätten, because you will have an accumulation of various remains, but also some of them appear to be really beautifully preserved. And it's not only insects we're talking about. There are a lot of examples of really cool, delicate fossils being preserved in coprolites, despite coprolites still being quite understudied. So there are examples of hair, feathers, even muscle tissue being preserved in coprolites, and parasite eggs, a lot of different things. So I think really you're onto something here, Dave. And of course, these things have to initially survive digestion. So, but if they do that, and if the dropping against all odds becomes preserved as a coprolite, chances are really high that whatever was still in the dropping will be really beautifully preserved.
If I can jump in, there's probably some reason why actually the insects and all the remains kind of are kept in 3D, right? Because all the other things, I think, is just compressed things in the site, right?
Exactly. So this is very common that within the coprolites, that is, you have this calcium phosphatic matrix, that the inclusions are 3D preserved, whereas in the host rock, things are usually flattened and compressed. So that's a really one important factor for the great preservation potential in coprolites, is that the inclusions are usually 3D preserved.
Okay, and so for all of the students that are listening, how would you convince them that they should study coprolites or beetles?
For the coprolite part, it's like, well, if you want to study coprolites, it's going to be very challenging because you're going to end up finding a lot of bits and pieces and being frustrated about trying to identify these and finding out and who the producer was and so on. But once you're able to do that, you're going to get some really cool paleoecological information. And it's really looking into, you know, the everyday life of these extinct animals, which I think is really, really cool. So I think coprolites are going to be, the study of coprolites is going to be more common in the future, and people are really going to appreciate what they find in there. I hope so, at least.
Yeah, for beetles, I think actually many people love beetles already, but mostly they just look at these big ones, right? So once most people hear about beetle, they imagine something like a rhinoceros beetle or Hercules beetle or something like that. But actually, these beetles are naturally super cool. I totally agree. But most beetles are tiny, and we don't know much about them, actually. We don't know how they live. We don't know how their larvae are looking like. We don't know how they interact with the environment, what they feed on, what kind of parasites they have. So there's so much unknown. It's like total separate big universe of what we can discover, right? So we need really many more people, because sometimes people think like, okay, there are so many people working on beetles, but we need many more, because we need especially students which are kind of having some unusual novel ideas. Okay, I would study something like, okay, swimming of water beetles. Like you can be surprised, but nobody did that before. Even though there are so many swimming beetles, and we have so many questions like that, like something which you can do at your home even without any super expensive equipment, and you can do really cool discoveries. So that's, I think, the potential of beetles and insects in general. You can kind of select some group. You have to have your eyes open, and you can kind of try to discover something which all the other people, all the generations before you, just overlooked, or they considered it as kind of boring and not interesting and not important, and they just kind of skipped it. The same way, actually, how many paleontologists skipped the coprolites before, right? So you can do the same with modern beetles. And then you can combine. You can combine that with fossils. You can cooperate with paleontologists like Martin. This is always cool to do some interdisciplinary things. So yeah, beetle science definitely is in need of more students, and there's so much to do. And you can do whatever you want. If you are good at molecules, you can do DNA. If you can, if you like to have alive beetles and hope, you can do at that. So it's, you can choose any kind of science you want to do, and that would be super cool.
Okay, both. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. I've learned so much, and I hope our audience have done as well.
And it was my pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Dave.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. But the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.